Rainbow Laces, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. There's a campaign in Britain to have athletes wear rainbow laces on their cleats to show support for the LGBT community. But is it working?
It's been really successful, actually. I mean, last year we engaged with around 12 million people in terms of those individuals that have seen the campaign through some sort of sporting outlet. And around 7 million of those felt more positive around LGBT inclusion in sport.
Plus, a word of caution from Latin America about using the military for domestic law enforcement.
I mean, I think it's a very dangerous line to take. You don't really want to give autonomy to armed institutions in that sense.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Thanks for joining us. About 8,000 members of the U.S. military are deployed right now on the American side of the southern border. The number includes more than 2,000 National Guard troops and nearly 6,000 active duty forces. The most prominent thing the troops have done so far? They've laid out rows of new razor wire in several places along the border fence. But the White House has also issued an order allowing the troops to take on some law enforcement roles. And that includes the use of lethal force if necessary. Here's President Trump talking about the new rules yesterday.
If they have to, they're going to use lethal force. I've given the okay. Yeah, if they have to, I hope they don't have to. But, you know, you're dealing with a minimum of 500 serious criminals. So I'm not going to let the military be taken advantage of. I have no choice. Do I want that to happen? Absolutely not. But you're dealing with rough people.
Some experts say the new directives are at odds with an old law. The Posse Comitatus Act goes back to the late 19th century, and it restricts active military members from engaging in civilian law enforcement roles on U.S. territory. William C. Banks is a professor of law at Syracuse University. I asked him about the history of the Posse Comitatus Act.
It's quite an interesting story, actually. It has to do with the Reconstruction in the United States post-Civil War period, where there was a tremendous amount of intimidation of newly enfranchised black voters in the South. So to assist in the Reconstruction efforts, the President Grant ordered military to serve at the polling stations during presidential and other elections there. Some say that the troops were there to intimidate voters in the presidential election in favor of the candidate of the prevailing party then, the Republicans. Others say that they were there to prevent the harassment and intimidation of the black voters. At any rate, the election of 1876 was so close that a deal was struck so that the losing candidate, the Democrat, agreed to not contest the election so long as the Republicans would pull the troops out of the South. And they basically did that in the form of the Posse Comitatus Act.
So how has it evolved over the years if the context for it was so specific to the years after the Civil War?
It's really quite fascinating because the law as it is written simply establishes what lawyers call a presumption that federal forces should not be used to enforce the law unless pursuant to the Constitution or another act of Congress. So it doesn't say you can't. It says that you have to have some other authority to be involved in law enforcement, the things that we always expect civilians to do. It's not focused on keeping the peace, for example, or on protecting national security. Over the years, the law, the Posse Comitatus Act, has taken on a sort of a larger life, if you will, so that military now are discouraged in their basic training and further training from engaging in domestic operations.
Bringing it up to the present, as you know, earlier this week, the White House signed this memo that would allow troops stationed at the border, the troops he's had sent down there, to take on some law enforcement roles, including using lethal force. According to your understanding, does this move violate the Posse Comitatus Act?
It depends on what actually happens. There is another statute called the Insurrection Act, which, if invoked by the president, could enable overcoming the presumption of Posse Comitatus, but it hasn't been invoked. It requires personal accountability by the president. at a determination that circumstances are so dire that the federal forces have to be used in this way. Last time that happened, by the way, was in response to the Rodney King verdict in Los Angeles in 1992.
We begin with a state of siege in Los Angeles. More than 35 people have died. More than 1,300 have been injured. More than 3,000 people are under arrest. The police and the National Guard do not yet have the city completely under their control.
So in 1992, were federal forces sent in and given the option of using lethal force?
They were. The California governor actually requested that involvement by President George H.W. Bush.
Early today, I directed 3,000 members of the 7th Infantry and 1,500 Marines to stand by at El Toro Air Station, California.
And the federal government was able to do that because it met the requirements of Posse Comitatus?
That's right. Insurrection, rioting, disturbance that the civilian forces and state National Guard were thought not to be able to control.
And so do those conditions, if you compare them to this current circumstance, does Trump's use of forces and reasons for it and reasons to give them the option of using lethal force, does it meet the requirements?
I don't think so. It still seems to me that there's no authority to deploy the forces in that posture to the border. There's not a national security crisis. There's not a disturbance that that civilian authorities cannot themselves remediate. And there are no threats of law violation. It hopefully in the next days, as the so-called caravans make their way closer to the border and there is no major disturbance, cooler heads will prevail and the deployed federal forces will simply be sent back to their bases. The state National Guard will remain as needed to provide logistics or other support. You know, as you know, Customs and Border Patrol has something like 20,000 agents deployed along the border, and there's no reason to expect so far that they aren't able to manage an influx, an even larger influx of migrants who wish to be admitted to the United States or to apply for asylum.
William Banks is a professor of law at Syracuse University, and he's co-author of Soldiers on the Home Front, The Domestic Role of the American Military. For a cautionary tale about using the armed forces for police work at home, look no further than our neighbor to the south. For more than 10 years, Mexico's army has played a central and often lethal role in fighting organized crime and drug cartels. Deborah Bonello is a journalist in Mexico City. Deborah, tell us the policy that's been in place since 2006 regarding the use of the Mexican army in Mexico.
The military has been fundamental in Mexico's crackdown on organized crime, which was started by Presidente Felipe Calderón in 2006-2007. So that has meant not only the use of the army, the Marines on the streets of the country to crack down on drug trafficking and the groups involved, but also the militarization of some of its police forces, which is something, of course, that you've seen throughout Latin America.
What do you mean by the militarization of the police force?
I mean, when Peña Nieto came in, which is Mexico's current president, he created something called the Gendarmerie, which is a kind of an sort of an elite police force, you know. So it's kind of these forces that are sort of a hybrid of military principles and police principles. You know, we know that the police are street cops. They're used to dealing with people on a daily basis. But military practice is more to do with, you know, combat and open warfare. And in fact, with incoming President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, he has suggested the creation of a National Guard, which would mix members of the army with members of the federal police and other security forces in Mexico. So no change there so far going forwards.
Now, Felipe Calderón's policy of using the Mexico's military in fighting drug cartels, many say that's resulted in just a soaring murder rate, you know, 80 murders a day, more than 31,000 murders in 2017. So the sense I get is that Mexico is looking for an alternative. And was Andrés Manuel López Obrador supposed to offer an alternative to the military being so involved in policing?
He was. And I think there's been quite a lot of surprise at the security plan that he unveiled last week, if only because you know, prior to being elected president, he was a critic of the use of the army. We must remember that it's not just the military that's responsible for this high death rate. A lot of that violence is to do with infighting between criminal groups, and it's also to do with the corruption throughout Mexico's security forces. But we have seen a lot of extrajudicial executions, disappearances, and other awful human rights abuses that have happened at the hands of the military.
Deborah, I understand there was an especially violent and awful video that circulated on CCTV about one of these extrajudicial killings. Tell us about that.
I think it was about a year ago where there was a big spate of the theft of gasoline from some of the pipelines that run around Mexico. And the army was sent in to stop that. And a video did the rounds on social media that showed a soldier executing an unarmed man on the ground. It was a tiro de gracia, we call it in Spanish. You know, he was killed by a single bullet to the head. Now, the unarmed man could well have been a suspected gas smuggler, and he may have been under arrest, whatever. He was detained, but he was unarmed. And yet the impact that that video had in Mexico was very small. You know, I remember doing some coverage on it, but there was no public outrage, which to me speaks not only of the impunity that the armed forces enjoy in Mexico, because their superiors didn't really feel the need to make an example of anyone, but also that the Mexican public now is so used to the use of force of this kind by security forces.
Are Mexicans divided on the use of the Mexican army playing such a huge role in policing?
I think they are, you know. I think it has been sort of la gente popular, you know, working class Mexicans who make up the vast majority of the population. It's been they who have been most affected by drug-related violence, both in terms of the areas they live in and the people and the victims who have been killed. So I think on the one hand, of course, they want to see criminal networks defeated and security returned to their towns and cities. I don't doubt that. But they're also probably fully aware that a lot of those disappearances and killings are carried out by the very security forces that are supposed to be protecting them.
Final question. Deb, when you hear that the White House, the Trump administration, is authorizing the U.S. military to act as law enforcement, you know, I know the two countries are very different and with this history and everything, but do you ever think, better think about that carefully?
Of course. I mean, I think it's a very dangerous line to take. You don't really want to give autonomy to armed institutions in that sense. I mean, the thing that is less threatening about Trump's words is that the US military and security forces in general, and I say this in general because we know there's a lot of corruption on both sides of the US-Mexico border when it comes to security, but there is more accountability. That said, you know, the American military, as we've seen in the wars in the Middle East, they are not trained to be in this interface with the public. And so things happen. I mean, we've seen that in the coverage of the Afghanistan wars and Iraq. And so I think he has to tread very, very carefully, especially because they have been dispatched to handle a hugely controversial issue right now, which is this caravan of migrants that are on the border with the United States-Mexico border, the animosity and polarization that exists in the U.S. today to do with that issue, which has been framed as an invasion by the Trump administration. So, yeah, it's a very dangerous line he's treading, I think.
Deborah Bonello is a freelance journalist based in Mexico City. Thanks a lot, Deb.
Thanks, Carol. Good talking to you.
Just a quick note here. Mexico's military has been operating in a law enforcement capacity for years. Last year, the Mexican Congress passed a law to formalize the arrangement. The Supreme Court overturned that law just last week. But many observers say it's not likely to make much difference. Coming up, one family's ordeal under Brazil's military dictatorship. That's next on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The president-elect in Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, is a former army captain who talks about the good old days. But Brazil's recent history includes two decades of military dictatorship. From 1964 to 1985, hundreds of Brazilians were disappeared, tortured, and killed for criticizing the government. One of them was a former congressman named Rubens Paiva. On a hot summer day in 1971, he was abducted from his home in Rio de Janeiro. His family endured years of official lies before finally learning the truth. Paiva's son, Marcelo, spoke recently to the BBC history program Witness. Here's Thomas Bapon with the story.
A socialist, Rubens Paiva had his mandate as congressman revoked a few days after the military coup in 1964, which he denounced as illegal in a speech broadcast on national radio.
Me dirijo especialmente a todos os trabalhadores.
All workers, all students, and all the people of the state of Sao Paulo who have been disgraced by its fascist government, I urge all to unite around their representatives, their unions, their student organizations to enforce a general strike.
He lived in exile in Yugoslavia and France for almost a year before moving back to Brazil, to Rio de Janeiro, where he worked as a civil engineer. His son, writer Marcelo Rubens Paiva, was 11 years old on the hot summer day in January 1971, when their house was invaded by six men with guns.
When they entered the house, my father asked them to calm down and put the machine guns away, which they did. They had intercepted letters in the airport from people living in exile addressed to my father. They thought they were going to raid some sort of subversive cell and were surprised to find a typical upper-middle-class family house with children. They closed all the doors and curtains and asked who else was in the house. My mother, Eunice, told them that there were four children there. Eliana, who was 15, Ana Lucia, 13, me and Beatriz, who was 10. It was the summer holiday. My older sister, Vera, was in London. Beatriz and I were sleeping. They woke us up and we were told to sit on the sofa in the living room. They ordered my father to go with them. They said they needed him to give a statement without saying where or why. He went upstairs to his room, put on a suit and tie, and left with three of them. We spent 24 hours locked in our house with the plainclothes officers who had stayed behind. We ate meals with them and played cards. We could do things, but we always had to return to the sofa. And we were totally convinced that my father would give the statement and come back.
At this point in his account, Marcelo Rubens Paiva is not only relying on his own memories, but also on what his mother told him later and what the family has learned from a report by Brazil's Truth Commission, published in 2014. Now they understand why his mother and 15-year-old sister were taken by the military the next day.
Por que minha mãe foi presa? Porque meu pai não estava falando na tortura.
Why was my mother taken? Because my father was not speaking under torture. He was tortured on the day he was arrested. The next day, he was in very bad shape. At the time, when someone didn't say what they wanted to hear, they brought in wives and daughters to torture them in front of the prisoner and make him speak. My mother and my sister were put in a cell, on a stool, their heads covered with hoods. They didn't know my father was there. All they heard was a man screaming. Later, witnesses who were at the army barracks where my father was being held confirmed that he was being tortured in a room next to where my mother and sister were and that he died that night. That's why they weren't tortured, because my father had died. The next day, they drove my sister to a neighborhood a long way from our house and left her there. But my mother was kept for 12 days in a cell at the end of a corridor. They didn't know what to do with her. They took me to a small farm in the countryside, which belonged to a friend of a friend of a friend. My sisters were taken to other places. I spent 12 days on that farm without knowing if I still had a father and a mother. I remember those days vividly, the feeling of having been abandoned. Only the housekeeper and his wife lived there. Then, after 12 days, my sister Eliana came to pick me up. When I saw my mother, I was so happy I couldn't stop crying. It was so intense I had an asthma attack. She was so skinny. She looked like she had lost 10 kilos in 12 days. My mother returned to the army barracks with clothes and medicine for my father. She was told that he wasn't there. She said, "How could that be? I was imprisoned here." They replied, "No, you were never imprisoned here." That was the moment we thought something very bad had happened to him.
The family started receiving false information, saying that Rubin Spiva was still alive but injured. Then came the official version, that he had escaped 2 days after his arrest, when he was being transported to another military unit, that the car was intercepted by terrorists, and that after a shootout, he disappeared. It was hardly a plausible story. The family's hopes were dwindling.
It was complicated. We couldn't afford to live in Rio anymore. My mother had to feed five kids and decided to study to become a lawyer. When we moved back to the city of Santos, to a house my parents had there, I told my friends at school that my father had been arrested. I had to explain he wasn't a criminal. After some time, we noticed that my sisters and I had all, in our own ways, buried my father. We didn't agree on a date, like, from now onwards we consider our father died, because officially he could still be alive. We had problems because of that. We had traveler's checks which couldn't be cashed in without his signature, accounts and investments which couldn't be touched. Only in the 90s, under President Fernando Henrique Cardoso, who was a friend of my father's, the families of the disappeared were issued with death certificates for their loved ones.
Decades later, after accounts given by an army doctor and former military officers to the Truth Commission, it was revealed that Rubin Spiva had died on the second day after his arrest of injuries inflicted by beatings at the army barracks. His remains have never been found. So why was he arrested and tortured? Because of a bundle of letters addressed to him, found at the airport, hidden in a package of sanitary pads, in the baggage of a female passenger coming from Chile. Letters which would have helped tell the world what was going on in Brazil.
Those letters were written by Brazilians who had been tortured and jailed and were living in exile after being exchanged for the lives of foreign ambassadors who had been kidnapped by left-wing groups in Brazil. You know that TV series Handmaid's Tale? The letters which tell what was going on, what was happening to the people living in that country. Those letters to my father were like that. Accounts of how people were tortured and by whom. And my father was the middleman. He knew many foreign journalists. He was a major source of information. He was going to take those letters to the foreign press.
Marcelo Rubin Spiva there, talking about the disappearance of his father, former Congressman Rubin Spiva, during Brazil's military dictatorship. Their story was told by the BBC's Thomas Bapon here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. A linguist who studies communication across languages finds the bilingual correspondence between a composer and his wife. He wrote in Swedish, she replied in Finnish.
They were doing what I've been studying all my life, and there are all these letters available.
What we could all learn from bilingual communication, coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills here with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston.
Last night I was the victim in my home city of a hate crime for my sexuality.
That's Gareth Thomas, a former captain of the Wales national rugby team. Thomas came out as gay in 2009 while he was still an active player. You don't see that much in men's professional sports, in Britain or anywhere. Last weekend, Thomas was assaulted in the city of Cardiff by a 16-year-old just because he's gay. Instead of pressing charges, Thomas asked police to allow him to deal with the attack through mediation. He also put out a short video message on Twitter showing his cuts and bruises.
I want to say thank you to the police who were involved and were very helpful and allowed me to do restorative justice with the people who did this, because I thought they could learn more that way than any other way. And also to the people of Cardiff who supported me and helped me, because there's a lot of people out there who want to hurt us, but unfortunately for them, there's a lot more that want to help us heal.
And this weekend, more's coming. Members of the national rugby teams of Wales and France will be wearing rainbow shoelaces in solidarity with him. The Rainbow Lace Campaign was started by the British LGBT rights group Stonewall. Kirsty Clark is their director of sport. She says at first, watching Thomas's video was hard to take.
Personally, it really hits hard, I think, when things like that happen. I'm a rugby player myself, and we feel that there's genuinely a rugby family, and it's really important to stand up, but not just across sport, but across society. I think what's really important is obviously we highlight that progress is being made, but there's by no means can we be complacent.
I know this weekend both the Welsh and French national rugby teams will be wearing rainbow laces supporting Thomas and the LGBTQ community as a whole. How significant is it that these two major rugby teams will be participating in this campaign?
I think it's really significant. We've worked very closely with England Rugby as well. We're also keen to work alongside the women's teams as well when the Red Roses, who are the England team, play Ireland. I think the engagement from the wider international rugby family through the French and Welsh teams is fantastic to see.
I know rainbow laces have been used to make a statement in other sports events, but bring us back to the beginning. How did it all start?
Yeah, so it started in around 2013, and it was really a response to mainly homophobia that was heard across football stadiums in this country, as you say, soccer in the States. And I think from there it really grew, and other sports also saw the need for them to have some sort of visible engagement with a campaign that looks to ensure that their sport is for everyone.
How successful has it been over the years?
It's been really successful, actually. I mean, last year we engaged with around 12 million people in terms of those individuals that have seen the campaign through some sort of sporting outlet. And around 7 million of those felt more positive around LGBT inclusion in sport, which is really fantastic for us. And this year we're looking to distribute around 100,000 pairs of laces, and we're currently on about 99,000. So in terms of the scale of the campaign, we've really got some reach.
You mentioned earlier you are a rugby player yourself. Given that, does this whole story with Gareth Thomas feel very personal to you?
Yeah, like I say, rugby in this country is one of those sports that you know, you play hard on the pitch, but then afterwards you genuinely feel that you're part of a rugby family. So, you know, to have that done, someone who doesn't just identify as LGBT, but is part of that rugby family, it hits hard.
You know, some soccer fans have certain reputations, or, you know, tough soccer fans in the UK. Do rugby fans tend to be kind of, you know, hey, we're all in this together? Or do rugby fans tend to be tough and kind of old world in terms of being kind of and intolerant?
Yeah, I think all fan groups are really different. Sometimes it doesn't just depend on the sport. It kind of depends on a number of factors. I think what's really important is the use of the Rainbow Laces campaign to maybe kind of break down some of those barriers and understand that their sport, in terms of being a fan, is genuinely open to everyone.
Kirsty Clark is with the British LGBT advocacy group Stonewall. On Tuesday, a federal judge in Detroit ruled that a U.S. law banning female genital mutilation is unconstitutional. The ruling has taken many people by surprise. The U.S. is one of more than 30 countries with laws on the books making female genital mutilation, or FGM, illegal. Congress passed the law here more than 20 years ago, but the case in Michigan was the first legal challenge, and it could mean a reversal. The judge dismissed charges against two Michigan doctors and six others accused of subjecting at least nine minor girls to the cutting procedure. Maria Taher is the co-founder of SEYO, an organization that helps survivors of FGM. I asked her for her reaction to this ruling.
Honestly, when I heard about it, I was just completely shocked. SEYO does a lot of work on survivor stories, and I was working on a story that we were going to be publishing, and then I got the news, and just it floored me.
Tell us what's happened here. What did the judge rule on?
So what looks like has happened is that the court has ruled that the federal law against female genital mutilation or female genital cutting is unconstitutional on the grounds that Congress didn't have authority to pass this law. And essentially, the judge was stating that this is something that is considered local criminal activity, and so that state authorities should pass this. So essentially, from what I understand, it's a jurisdictional issue.
Clear something up for me. Why are state laws needed if there was a federal law in place?
Yeah, that's a great question. So currently, there are 27 laws in the U.S. that have state laws. But, you know, the reason that we need that is, again, just to reinforce that this is something that is a violation of human rights. It's a form of gender-based violence. It's a form of child abuse. But also, in particular, a lot of laws can add to the need for community education and outreach. It can also add issues of providing civil remedies to survivors if in case they choose to go that route. And unfortunately, if it's happening within the state, that falls under the jurisdiction of the state. So that's something that we do need to have those state laws, but we need both, really.
So with this ruling, is FGM now once again legal across the nation?
No. So that was something that was made very clear. Again, there are 27 states that do have specific laws banning female genital cutting or mutilation. And so it's still against the law there. But even if though there are 23 other states that don't have laws, it still would fall under existing child abuse, sexual assault laws too.
I know you experienced FGM yourself. Are you able to tell us about that?
Sure. For me, I did undergo it when I was seven, and I come from the same religious community involving the doctor in this trial. I don't really remember a lot about my own experience. It did, obviously, it affected me and impacted me. My recognizing that it can impact people in different ways, emotionally, physically, and sexually, I think I've come to terms with what has happened. But there are a lot of complicated emotions involved, and there are many survivors out there that are still trying to learn how to deal with the consequences of what has happened to them. And I think it's important to recognize that, again, trauma comes in many different forms, and this is something that can have long-term lasting effects emotionally, physically, and psychologically.
Do you remember at what age you started thinking about this seriously and thought, I've got to do something about this?
Many communities where it's practiced, you grow up believing it's normal. And so that's what I believed. And I didn't even think to question it until I was in high school. And, you know, at that time when I questioned it, it was only because a friend of mine had mentioned the words female genital mutilation. I don't think I even realized what those words meant before that, and basically said that we had undergone it. And that was when I started looking into it more. At the time, though, ironically, when I looked into it, I didn't see anything about it happening to American girls or to girls outside of countries within Africa. My family background comes from India. It had been so ingrained in this culture and justified in all these ways that it's really difficult for communities to unlearn it. It's not impossible. We are seeing change happening.
Do you feel like it's still an important issue in the U.S.? Is it growing? Is the number of incidences going down?
I think that it's definitely a very important issue in the United States. It's something that we don't really have a clear picture in terms of data and figures. We do know the CDC, or the Center for Disease and Control, did a study a couple of years ago and found that around 500,000 women and girls in the U.S. have undergone it. But I do believe that that figure is an underrepresentation of the true figure, because when you go into the weeds and understand that research, you realize that research actually includes certain populations and countries. And so, for instance, myself or the girls involved in the Michigan case, none of us would be included in that statistic. It's really misunderstood. And unfortunately, there's a lot of silence around who this happens to. And so we just don't really know what the true figure is.
Maria Taher is the co-founder of SIO, an organization that helps survivors of FGM. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
One country where female genital mutilation is still a common practice is Sudan. A majority of Sudanese girls and women are cut, or as some refer to the practice, circumcised. But Sudan's government is hoping to put an end to FGM nationwide by 2030. There's one Sudanese village that's already way ahead of schedule. No girls there are subjected to FGM. My BBC colleague Anne Soy went there to find out how that happened.
Celebration time in Sheikh al-Basir village in Jazeera State, south of Khartoum. About 30 to 40 men are standing in a circle, dancing and singing. And they have every reason to celebrate. This village has completely turned its back on female genital mutilation. I'm told it hasn't been practiced since the 90s. In fact, nobody talks about it here anymore. It all started in 1983, when one man decided that was it for him and his family. Ahmed Mohammed used to work in Saudi Arabia. He found out that FGM was not practiced there. There was no religious connection.
There are many reasons why it's wrong. Women died during the oppression. It causes young women not to have sexual desires. Our religion does not allow it. Therefore, we decided not to do it. My wife was under huge pressure to do it, but thankfully, she refused.
His wife, Khadija, was shunned by neighbors, but not anymore. I met up with her at the local mosque in the company of 30 or so women.
They used to try and scare me by saying, "Who is going to marry my girls? They will never get married." I said, "I don't care. When the boys come along and want to marry them," their father said, "he'll tell them our daughters are not cut, and if they don't want the girls, then they're free to leave."
Behind me, a young woman opens up about her suffering.
I was among the last to be circumcised in this village. I was born in 1989. I suffered a lot in my sexual life and childbirth, and I continue to suffer today. I'm not going to be like a normal girl who has not been cut.
The women are now reciting verses from the Quran. Many people here use the holy book to justify FGM, but that's now being challenged by religious teachers in Sudan.
I think female genital mutilation is against Islamic values and it causes health problems to the girls. We encourage the villagers nearby to follow us, and they have.
But it's midwives like Amira Abdul Rahman and mothers and grandmothers who continue to have the biggest say. They hold the key to ending the practice. Amira says she cut many girls, including her own daughters and granddaughters. But she stopped after a near-fatal incident.
I made a big mistake. I wish God would forgive me too. The children saw me as if I was the angel of death. If I could speak to them, I would ask for forgiveness.
Most girls here are cut young, at 7, 8, or even as young as 3 years of age. But there are efforts now, supported by British Aid, to teach them early about the harmful effects of FGM. A group of 7 preteens are performing a skit in front of their school. I'm in Ella School in Jazeera State, south of Khartoum. The performers are dressed in colourful scarves. They're part of what is called the Salima Project. This is a group of girls who have come together. They hold girls-only clubs, and they have declared that they will not be subjected to genital mutilation. Salima means as God intended.
The BBC's Anne Soy reporting there from Jazeera State in Sudan. From our language desk, Patrick Cox is here in the studio with me, and he's got one of his favorite language stories from 2018. Patrick, where are you taking us today?
Okay, we're going to end up in one of Europe's northernmost nations and hear the story of a composer and the lifelong bilingual correspondence he had with his wife. But this story has a sort of a prologue in Africa in 1967 and the breakaway Republic of Biafra. Biafra was a part of Nigeria, and its attempt at nationhood didn't last long. War, a blockade, and starvation led to more than a million deaths. And so, 2.5 years after declaring independence, Biafran leaders surrendered to the Nigerian army. All they had to show for it was this, a national anthem. The music this anthem's based on had been on quite a tour of the world by the time it arrived in West Africa. Along the way, it had acquired words and been transformed into a hymn, several hymns. But it began its life in a place as unlike tropical Africa as you're likely to find. You can figure out where from its title, Finlandia.
Finlandia is the sort of unofficial national anthem of Finland.
Finlandia was written by the country's greatest composer, Jean Sibelius. And here's the tie-in with Biafra. When Sibelius wrote Finlandia, Finland wasn't yet a country. It was part of the Russian Empire, a grand duchy. Sibelius wrote Finlandia as a protest against that, a declaration of Finnish cultural identity. Finns fell in love with it. They're still in love with it. Most of them, anyway.
Whenever they show like old films of, you know, the World War II Finnish soldiers fighting the Russians, they had Finlandia in the background. It's sort of trite.
This is Sauli Pile, by the way, born and raised in Finland. He's in his 30s, lives in the US now. He's not a big fan of Sibelius or Finlandia until late last year when he was back in Helsinki for a visit.
It was the 100-year anniversary of Finnish independence this December. And it was the Independence Day night, and it was right next to the harbor where, you know, they have the presidential castle and the city hall. And when I was waiting for the fireworks, they were playing Finlandia. And I was watching the fireworks, and I felt something. I felt like, wow, I actually did feel proud. Maybe I was just, you know, I've had a few drinks, and I felt so sentimental, but it was quite beautiful.
For many Finns, this music conveys the very essence of what it is to be Finnish, to live in a land of dark forests and hidden lakes and ice. But maybe it also just as strongly evokes the lush hills and humidity of Biafra. That may have been the genius of Jean Sibelius, to imbue his music with such a strong sense of place that two totally unrelated groups of people could lay claim to it. He had a dual nature in all kinds of ways. Like, his symphonies were both traditional and radical. Plus, he was a devoted husband and father who also nearly drank himself to death. And he spoke and corresponded with his wife in two languages, his native tongue and hers. And so it happens that their letters to each other are full of clues about how we communicate when we communicate bilingually, whether it's day-to-day chit-chat or our innermost feelings. In 1989, Helena Halmari came to the US from her native Finland to study. She's still here, a professor of linguistics now at Sam Houston State University in Texas, and a mother of three grown children. Her big academic obsession has always been bilingual communication, how people who speak two languages speak to each other in those languages.
And my own children, they were a big part of my research.
It can happen if you're the kids of academics. For years, Helena researched what might be happening when bilinguals switched languages, whether there were rules to it, not just random patterns. And then in 2015, along came the 150th anniversary of the birth of Jean Sibelius, a big deal for any self-respecting Finn. Helena started reading about Sibelius and his wife Aino. His mother tongue was Swedish, hers Finnish. He was on the road a lot, so for much of their life together, they wrote to each other, and their correspondence was now available to the public.
I started thinking about Sibelius and Aino, and I started to think, this is what they were doing. They were doing what I've been studying all my life, and there are all these letters available.
Aino was 17 when she fell in love with the 22-year-old Jean. Almost immediately, they were apart, and so began the letters.
In the beginning of their correspondence, he says, I'm writing in Swedish so that I don't have to think about every single word.
His Finnish just wasn't that good.
And he's asking, are there mistakes here? And Aino answers in the next letter, Aino answers, everything is very fine, your Finnish is very fine, there were some extra dots on an A in one word. So Aino writes, those dots on the A were so cute that I had to kiss them several times.
Okay, if anyone suggests to you that Finns are passionless technocrats, just tell them that story.
So, Patrick, did Sibelius' Finnish improve over the years?
Yes, and later on in life, his letters to Aino often switched between Finnish and Swedish. You know, as a patriotic Finn, he really wanted to master the language, but he never really quite did. I think he made up for it with his music, don't you think?
I think so.
Thanks so much, Patrick.
You're welcome, Carol.
And that's it from us on this Thanksgiving week. Happy Black Friday, folks. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.